Good evening. I really appreciate this opportunity to stand before you. It's quite a privilege. This evening, I'd like to talk about loving God in your heart. I'd like to start with a couple different verses. I'm going to go through rather quickly. 1 Corinthians 2 and verse 2. Paul says, I determined not to know anything among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. In 1 Peter 1 and verse 8, we're told to rejoice with joy inexpressible and full of glory. In Hebrews 3 and verse 1, we're told to fix your thoughts on Jesus. How much greater of a thing can we have done in this life than to fix our thoughts on Jesus? Thinking more about him, caring more about him, caring more about the Father. As I go through the Bible, the more I study it, I see a basic pattern that's there, that if we know God, we will love him. And if we love him, we will obey him. And if we obey him, we will bear fruit. Now, I would start out by saying that some that know him aren't going to love him. Some will hate him. But there's only two basic reactions. If you actually get to know Christ and the Father, you will have a strong attraction or repulsion to him. There's only two basic responses, loving or hating. I hope that each of us, as we learn more and more about him, love him even more. But it's very difficult to stay neutral. The problem that I've run into in the past is that I focused on the last two at times in my life, thinking that I could obey him and bear fruit without really getting to know him or really loving him that much at times, thinking I could just gain knowledge and do works and be pleasing to him in that way. And the more I study, the more I realize you're not obeying him if you don't know him and love him, because that's foundational to what he wants you to do and to be. And that it really works from the bottom up. That if you want to bear fruit and you're not, then I contend you don't truly know him. Because if you truly knew him, you would love him. And if you really loved him, you'd obey him. And through the obedience, the fruit would come. You wouldn't have to struggle and struggle to fight to make the fruit happen. It would come naturally and easily. I'd like to turn to Luke 10 and verse 27. When we talk about loving God, this is a very common verse to go to. You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your strength, with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself. But at times when I've read that in the past, it kind of eluded me as to exactly what he meant by that. I love him with everything. It just seemed all-encompassing. But I've sometimes had difficulty applying it. I found this somewhere some years back as three key points under that. I don't even remember where now. But to me, I can apply it a lot easier if I put it within the context of my head, my heart, and my hands. If I learn about him and gain knowledge through logic and reason, through my head, studying and reading and learning, that's one aspect that we need to do. We need to read his word and learn more about him and what he wants for us. But we also need to give him our heart. We need to have feelings and emotion and concern and care and love genuinely from the heart. And we need to engage our hands with action and obedience, with good deeds, doing the things that he's told us to do. When I break it down this way, for me at least, it becomes more meaningful and I believe works off of the same principles that he's talking about here. Well, I found that in my life in the past, I found head and hands to be easier than heart. I think men sometimes struggle more with the heart aspect of it. And that's something I've had to work on over time, trying to soften my heart and love him and be able to say that I do. There needs to be a balance between the three. That if you get out of balance and just focus on one aspect or two, it's not a complete love for him. It's not how he would want you to be. You can think of different religious groups or different people that emphasize one or two aspects of these, and they sometimes run around without knowledge, doing things that seem mighty, but not the way that God would have them. Or they sit in a monastery and read and study and have lots of knowledge, but they're not actually doing the things that God would have them to do. It requires all three aspects. Well, what I would like to suggest with this is that serving Christ is a lot more than just following a list of rules. That there's a relationship that we enter into with him. And that it goes very deep within our lives, such that we're the branches and he's like a tree trunk that we've attached ourselves to, that we draw our nourishment from, that he's that steady base that holds us secure. The way that God teaches us, a lot of the time through his word, is through stories. It's not written like a tax code. How many of us would fall in love with a tax code or the writer of a tax code? It's usually a very dreadful thing come the beginning of the year and it's time to start working on taxes, or for most of us at least. I know at least one person here that enjoys taxes. I don't. I don't like reading tax code. It's not exciting. It doesn't cause me to have strong emotions of a positive nature. Instead, God teaches us and tells us to be courageous. And then he gives us some stories of David and Goliath, of Daniel and his three friends being taken to Babylon, about Noah being told to build an ark, where the people, it appears, had never seen rain before. And he's mocked and laughed at for a long, long time, preaching to them and not being very successful. But when he tells us to be courageous and he gives us some stories and examples, it touches our heart. Because that's what he intends, is to reach us deep down. And what I'd like to suggest is that the best stories have a few common traits. That things were good, that something bad happened, and that somebody, against all odds, comes to the rescue. And in the end, they prevail. Think of the best movies or books that you like. Don't they typically have a theme like this? Well, God wrote the original stories, and the rest are just copies, imitations, knockoffs of his stories. Or that you think about the gospel story, where that things were good, so very good, and something bad happened. And after a long, long time, the most unlikely person, the Son of God, came to the rescue in the most unassuming ways, as a baby, as an infant, to a poor family. And through the most unlikely of means, his own death, became victorious and prevailed. Well, I believe that the way that the Bible is written and what God tells us is that I believe God is very romantic. I think he has a very, very strong sense of romance. And so first I'd ask, well, what is romance? When I looked it up, I got two basic definitions. It's a feeling of excitement and mystery associated with love. And it also means to woo or to court, to chase, and to pursue. Does that fit God's relationship toward us? Does he woo us, court us, chase us, and pursue us? Yes, he does. He wrote things that would appeal to us, that would enthrall us, to call us to himself, giving us a feeling of excitement and mystery associated with his love in a way that a tax code never could. There's so many stories in the Bible and so many metaphors for how his relationship toward us is that to me, one of the ways that I see it in the way that it's presented, but it's a little less direct. God is the king sitting on a throne in a majestic castle who sent his son, the prince, to go battle the dragon, who's the devil, to redeem us because he loves us and wants us to be with him. Couldn't you imagine being a peasant out in the fields and the king desiring for you to live there in the castle with him? So he literally sends his son out, the prince, to go battle a great dragon that's holding you captive, so that you could go live in the castle with him, in his kingdom. It's majestic, it's powerful. I believe those metaphors are woven throughout the scriptures. If you meditate on the person who did this, the person who planned this from before time, that he put all this in motion, planning to redeem us in such a noble and powerful way. For God is a person, not a set of rules. That we know him and worship him, for he is a person. Not a person physically like we are in the same way, we understand, but to where he has a personality, he is an entity, he has a will, he has a creation that he's made. And he wants us to worship him, truly, deep down. I'd like to turn to Hosea chapter 2. This seems like an unlikely place to talk about God's romance toward us. For God told Hosea to go and marry a harlot, who turned out to be Gomer, who was unfaithful to him, which symbolized the unfaithfulness of the nation of Israel. And through the wretched things that went on, he is teaching us about unfaithfulness toward him. But also then, in Hosea 2, 14 through 20, he talks about a time and a people that will be faithful to him. Therefore, behold, I will allure her, will bring her into the wilderness and speak comfort to her. I will give her her vineyards from there, and the valley of Achor as a door of hope. She shall sing there, as in the days of her youth, as in the days when she came up from the land of Egypt. And it shall be in that day, says the Lord, that you will call me my husband, and no longer my master. Wouldn't that be an awesome thing for God to think of us in such a strong relationship as though we're a wife to him? That metaphor is used many times through the scriptures. No, I don't believe physically will we be his wife in heaven. I think this is a metaphor for his love for us. There's several others such as that we're his sons. But to me, this is such a strong and powerful metaphor that I really like this. For I will take from her mouth the names of the Baals, and they shall be remembered by their name no more. In that day I will make a covenant for them with the beasts of the field and the birds of the air, with the creeping things of the ground. Bow and sword of battle I will shatter from the earth to make them lie down safely. I will betroth you to me forever. Yes, I will betroth you to me in righteousness and justice, in loving kindness and mercy. I will betroth you to me in faithfulness, and you shall know the Lord. I contend that God is intensely romantic. It's easy to go through and pick out some of the verses that tell us to do something specific and just see some rules to follow. And we need to follow the things that he says to do. We need to obey him. But first, We need to truly come to know him and love him deep down so that we want that kind of relationship as a son to a father or as a wife to the husband, to where we know him and have that closeness and that bond. Well, how would we go about knowing him and loving him? Well, one thing I would say is learning to appreciate what he's done. You look around at what God has made. Look at the things that you enjoy. If you think about your family, doesn't your family bring you a lot of joy? That was God's idea. He came up with that. What about good food? You know, blueberry season is quickly beginning. We really like blueberries in our household. That's a present from God for us to have the bountiful seasons. Music, laughter, watching a sunset out over the ocean. I know Bess is going to go fishing this week, and I bet she's going to watch a sunset out over the ocean at least once during the week, not a couple times. That's God's creation. We didn't come up with that. We just like to take pictures of it or paint pictures of it because what God did is so magnificent and awe-inspiring and beautiful. Do you have a sense of awe when you think about God? When you think of his power and majesty, of his ability and his love, what he could have done with us but chose not to, we could have been just like robots with no sense of will, just forced to do whatever he wanted. Instead, he gave us a free will, allowing us to do what we choose, but then telling us what pleases him, hoping that we would do what pleases him. Well, when I think about some of the greatest followers of God, when I think from the Old Testament, David comes to mind right off, a man after God's own heart. When I think of the New Testament, Paul comes to mind, passionate in their love of God, expressive of their love. These are manly men that publicly wrote about their love of God. These are not some kind of wimpy guys who were just writing romantic things all the time. Quite the opposite. These are dangerous men. Men you wouldn't want to get in a tangle with. They could kill you if they did. Both of them were very capable. But they also had a very passionate love for God. And they were willing to demonstrate that to others and write about it and tell others about that. In Psalm 18, 1 through 3, that we had as the reading before it began. Where David says, I will love you, O Lord, my strength. The Lord is my rock and my fortress and my deliverer. My God, my strength, in whom I will trust, my shield, my horn of my salvation, my stronghold. I will call upon the Lord, who is worthy to be praised. So shall I be saved from my enemies. This is a man who truly loves the Lord out of his heart. Not just obeying some rules in order to get something. Quite the opposite. This is a man who looks to the Father and wants to praise him. Wants to bow his knee and praise him for who he is and what he has done and how great he is. I turn to Ephesians 3. Reading 17 through 19 of Ephesians 3. And just for sake of time, I'm just cutting out a few verses here. It's longer. It's beautiful. You should go back and read the longer part of it. That Christ may dwell in your hearts through faith, that you, being rooted and grounded in love, may be able to comprehend with all the saints what is the width and the length and the depth and the height, to know the love of Christ, which passes knowledge, that you may be filled with all the fullness of God. That sounds like a man whose heart is on fire. that's in love and knows it and is willing to tell the world how he feels. Tell the world throughout all generations. It's written down in the most popular book ever written. Throughout all generations, get to read about his love for God. If I turn over to Luke 7, and think about a woman who had an intense love for Jesus. Luke 7, 37 and 38. When you think about Mary, and it says, "Behold, a woman in the city who was a sinner, when she knew that Jesus sat at the table in the Pharisee's house, brought an alabaster flask of fragrant oil, and stood at his feet behind him weeping. She began to wash his feet with her tears and wiping them with the hair of her head. And she kissed his feet and anointed them with fragrant oil." There's people around watching that are criticizing her. She doesn't care. She ignores them. She adores Christ and does not care who sees it or who's watching. She's not trying to make a show of it, quite the opposite. She's trying to show the Lord how much she loves him, regardless of what anyone else thinks. I need to be more like that. We all need to be more like that. So how can we be more like that? One way, I think, is to say, "I love you, Jesus," out loud, and to do it regularly. Feels kind of odd if you've never actually said that before. But to say, "I love you, Jesus," to think of the reasons why you love him and make a list of some of those reasons. And not just that he came and died for us, but think of some other reasons why you love him. A few reasons why I do. The first one I listed was, in the different times that he healed them in a completely different manner. He didn't just have one set way of just putting his hand on him or something, or just speaking a few words. He used a completely different way most of the time. One time, he touched somebody. Another time, he spit into the dirt, made some clay, rubbed it on the man's eyes. Another time, he spoke. Another time, someone touched his garment and was healed. There's a certain magic and mystery about him as to how he works. Another thing I love about him is his sense of humor. If I turn over to Luke 24, Luke 24, 17 through 19, and really just paraphrasing some of this, he's walking along down the road with a couple people who are very sad, and they don't realize who he is. And he turns and says, "Well, why are you sad?" And then they turn back to him and say, "Well, are you the only stranger in Jerusalem? And have you not known the things that have happened here these days?" And he turns to them and says, "What things?" I just chuckle when I read that. When you think of the thousands of years that have taken place on the earth from creation up to this time, the thousands of years of the time of the earth, plus the time before the earth was even created, when God had put this into plan and into motion. There's thousands and thousands of years going on here, building up to Christ coming and dying and being buried and resurrected for us. And he pretends to not know what they're talking about. It's hilarious. He has a great sense of humor. He taught with some awesome stories. He was a great storyteller. Now, sometimes we think of stories as being something not true. Well, that's not what I mean at all. By teaching through telling stories, like the prodigal son, he could have just stated a few things that he wanted us to believe or know or to be like. But instead, he taught some stories that stick with you a lot deeper. that are a lot more meaningful this way. The unforgiving servant. I just give you that title and you remember instantly what it's about and how you should be different as a result. The Good Samaritan, which is an oxymoron because to them there was no such thing as a Good Samaritan. To them it would have jumped out in their mind that, what do you mean a Good Samaritan? To us, we use that term so loosely, we kind of think that all Samaritans were good. They weren't. He taught powerful stories that gave powerful lessons. We're just hearing the story. You can immediately start applying it to your life. That's one of the things I love about him. Another thing that I love about him was that the creation was made through him. Nothing natural or scientific requires that elephants exist. If evolution would have just happened, if that could have happened over trillions of years or however long they now say it would have taken, there's nothing about evolution or any natural laws of science that would have made elephants exist. There's no reason why they just came into being. Or snow, or dolphins, or so many other things that are just majestic and awe-inspiring to us. When you think about what he created with such abundance and amazement, we see it all the time, so we've grown cold toward it. When you actually look around at the flowers out in the yard and think about how beautiful one little daisy is, how hard it would be to create one if you had to, it's just impossible. How that they can pass on life again. One of the greatest enemies toward holiness is not passion, but apathy. If you come and sit and sing a few songs week after week, year after year, without actually feeling it on the inside, I've done that before. It's not very good. But when you actually get to know Jesus and truly love him, when you know the Father and love him, then it's easy to obey them, to love them and obey them and to bear fruit related to that. Well, tonight, the invitation is in the hopes that you'll love God more, that it will come from a genuine place in your heart, not just so that you can get something from him, although we want to go to heaven, but don't just love him, or don't just obey him from the standpoint of trying to gain something. Love him for who he is, for his majesty, for the mystery associated with this, for how majestic he is, so powerful, for the promises that he gives us, for the creation that he's given us. Love him deep down in your heart. The invitation tonight is, if you haven't been doing that, come and ask how we can help. Let us know and we'll be there for you. Or if there's something else in your life that's not right, let us know and we're there for you, not to judge you, but to assist you and help you. If there's anything we can do for you tonight, please come forward as we stand and sing.